All right, there we go. Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by, why don't you just say your name and your title real fast, Tim?
Yes, sir. It's Tim Gordon, president of WAFCA, as well as CEO of the Black Reel Awards.
And we go way back, you know, used to, gosh, my predecessor at TOP, Joe Barber, you used to be his co-host, the two movie critics around town everybody would listen to together. We miss Joe. I know you have a award named after him at WAFCA. Love him, miss him. So anyway, we met years ago, and so just so our listeners know, you know, Tim and I go back, we do panels at Middleburg and all kinds of stuff. But I wanted to talk with you because you know, around this time of year, Valentine's Day, you see all these lists of, you know, of the best romantic movies ever. And I feel like I'm guilty of this too. You know, sometimes you go through and you're cherry picking, you're going back and looking at, you know, the AFI and all these lists, and then you realize Oscar voters have been mostly white men. People that make these lists are mostly white men. And a lot of times some really great Black stories of love get lost in the shuffle so many times. So I wanted to have you on the expert, sir, and tell our listeners some other ones they should be looking out for.
Well, you know, good point. Every year I try to specify and find and curate a list of films. And this year I created a series that we started on February the 1st called 28 Days of Black Love on the Silver Screen. And every day I kind of present a movie to folks. Some are more well-known than others. I've found some films that are obscure. So it's educational, it's entertainment, and it's been a lot of fun, Jason. So I'm glad that you brought me on to kind of shed a little light on what we're doing.
Yeah, well, every year I see you do the posts, and it's like a movie every day. And, you know, some of them even I haven't even seen. And I'm like, all right, thanks, Tim, for the recommendation. Put that on the list.
That's part of why we do it.
Exactly. So we have you have 28. I'll throw the full list of 28 up online. But let's highlight a couple of them here. I'll throw one out, and then I'll let you, you know, say why you think it's so important. So, Carmen Jones, 1954, I know it's Otto Preminger, the great Otto Preminger. I guess this sort of falls between like Laura and Anatomy of a Murder, is somewhere in there. I think it was up for even the Palme d'Or and maybe even won the Globe for like best picture for comedy musical. But tell me the star-studded cast, tell me why you love this one so much.
Well, I love this movie so much because it's based on the opera, and I guess they had a stage play back in 1943 of Carmen that they used as the adaptation. Of course, an all-Black cast at the time, of course, led by Dorothy Dandridge, who would go on to become the first African-American woman nominated for Best Actress for her performance in this film. Harry Belafonte. There were a lot of young actors who would grow to prominence later on. People like Diane Carroll made her film debut in this motion picture. Pearl Bailey was in this film. Brock Peters, who would later go on to have a stellar television and film career and support. So an amazing story, a transcendent performance by Dorothy Dandridge. And, you know, this movie, she lost, of course, that year to Grace Kelly for Country Girl. But she is every bit deserving of a nomination. And Harry Belafonte is fantastic. Two beautiful people, wonderful score. Not so happy message at the end, but a really good film, Jason. Nevertheless, and for people who haven't seen it, I would highly recommend checking out Carmen Jones.
Perfectly said. And yeah, as you say, some of these romance movies don't always have happy endings, but there's plenty of there's the rom-coms that are happy, and then sometimes there's the tragics or there's breakup movies or whatever. But Carmen Jones is a landmark film. Like you said, to have Dandridge and Carol in the same movie, that's crazy. All right, cool. Moving ahead now. Now we're in the 60s, 1968. For the Love of Ivy, Sidney Poitier, of course, the previous year he did his trio of iconic movies with In the Heat of the Night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and To Sir with Love. But this one, he comes back for The Love of Ivy, a little Quincy Jones Oscar nominated song. Tell me why you love For the Love of Ivy.
Well, again, Sidney Poitier from 67, as you said, with that trio of films, he was the number one box office draw in Hollywood and had his pick of any movie. And his next movie, he takes on the role of kind of standard Poitier. He's kind of an entrepreneur who runs a business that's a front. By day, he's a prominent businessman. By night, it's kind of he has a trucking business that they have gambling going on in the trucks at night. And he, one of the families that he works with, they have a maid played by Abby Lincoln who is threatening to leave them. And their idea, the family's idea, is that if we can find a man for her, then she will stay. So they draft Poitier, this businessman, to date this woman who is a maid. And you have this kind of very interesting dynamic and juxtaposition in this relationship that grows to a love relationship. Not the finest Poitier movie, but a very different image or a very different side of Poitier that we hadn't seen up until this point. So for that, I think it deserves a watch because two fine actors, of course, as I said, Lincoln and Poitier. You know, Carol O'Connor plays in this film 2 or 3 years before. He plays Archie Bunker, so you see him early in this film. Bo Bridges, really, really good film.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting it. Moving ahead now, I like how you're picking a couple from each decade. I like it. So if Carmen Jones was the 50s, For the Love of Ivy was in the 60s. Now we're moving to the 70s with Claudine, James Earl Jones, the great, and then, of course, Diane Carroll. I think Oscar nominated here, coming really into her own here after, you know, she debuted in Carmen Jones, like you said, but here she's carrying the show. Why do you love Claudine?
Well, Claudine, you know, the backstory of this film, I think it's also endearing because the role was initially for the late Diane Sands, who her and Carol were best friends, and she was dying of cancer. So she wanted Diane Carroll to do the role, and Carol took it on. This story of a woman who has 6 kids and is a domestic who falls in love with a guy who's a garbage man, who takes the responsibility of taking her on with these 6 kids. It is just funny, and to watch them falling in love on screen is absolutely great, along with the trials and tribulations and the different challenges they are dealing with in the early 1970s. As you said, Diane Carroll got an Oscar nomination for this film. I still think it's a very beloved film in the African-American community, and there for so many people, I want to shed a light on this movie, because it deserves a much wider audience than I feel that it's got.
And maybe people listen to this, we'll go check it out. I think you're doing everyone a service. So thanks for holding up, Claudine. All right, cool. Moving ahead now, we have one from the 90s, a little bit more of my era. Love Jones, Lawrence Tate, Nia Long. I believe it won like a drama award at Sundance. Why do you love Love Jones?
Man, Love Jones, if you walk down the street and grab any person of color and ask them what their favorite romantic film is, they will tell you unequivocally that Love Jones, the chemistry between Tate and Long in this film, the story of a couple among a group of friends and how they connect. And again, you know, what makes a good romantic film is that you see the two people come together, overcome their challenges, understand that they feel a certain way about each other, and then decide to open up their hearts and give each other an opportunity to kind of inhabit a space. This film is funny, it's witty. It was shot in Chicago by a young filmmaker named Theodore Witcher for reasons that we don't understand, Jason, who literally never made another film again. But his first and only film he made quite an impact, and with a dynamite cast, including Lisa Nicole Carson, Bill Bellamy in support, Harold Perrineau. I mean, it's just a wonderful cast of characters who would go on and have significant careers as well. But Love Jones, to me, is the standard, the platinum standard, when you're talking about these sorts of romantic films featuring people of color or African Americans.
And I want to drill down on that a little bit. What you said, we don't know why he never made another movie. I mean, That always surprised, like Charles Laughton makes Night of the Hunter and a classic and never makes another one. Why did he not? Was it just lack of opportunity? Why?
You know, I've been pondering and have wanted to find Theodore Witcher for years to ask him that question. I know he does work in television now. He's not even directing in television. He's like line producing or doing some other stuff behind the scene. I'm not sure if it's something that he had the experience once and just didn't want to do it again, whether he didn't have the opportunity. But the fact that Love Jones is such a beloved film and he never wanted to revisit it, never wanted to revisit or never had the opportunity to revisit directing again is one of the most odd things. You talked about Charles Laughton. That's another one. Like, you know, Night of the Hunter is right. Such a great film. You never wanted to make another one? That's it?
What? I know, like, wow. Harper Lee writes To Kill a Mockingbird, never writes another book. Like, those little things, they always surprise me. Like, why the one-offs are just, they blow my mind. But maybe they're like, all right, I'm good. I've done it.
Maybe that's a future series, the one-offs.
Right. There you go. Yeah. Well, anyway, if anyone's listening to this, a producer or something, and you're looking for a director, maybe go back and watch Love Jones, and because there you go. He's ready to go.
Witcher. Yeah.
All right. And then a couple years after that, Love and Basketball, the year 2000, I know it's a beloved movie for folks in my generation. Omar Epps, God, I feel like he was everywhere in the 90s. I loved him in the program. He Can't Let Go of the Ball in Class and Major League 2. He reunites with Pedro Serrano in this movie. They're both, Haysbert is in this movie too. He was Willie Mays Hayes after Wesley Snipes. But Higher Learning, right. he was everywhere, Omar Epps. Talk about why this kind of is the perfect marriage of a sports movie and a romance.
Well, Gina Prince-Bythewood, this was her debut film. And she, of course, the character of Monica that Sanaa Lathan inhabits is actually her. So there's this backstory of how she auditioned all these actresses, but she wanted an actress, who could actually play and actually act. And it was very difficult. So Sanaa Lathan ends up taking the role, and she's now talked about how grueling, and it was probably one of the worst experiences of her life. But it being the worst experiences of her life produced a movie, as you said, which is the perfect marriage of romance and sports, about two people who grow up together. They live next door to each other, and they both play basketball. And she's accomplished in her own right, but she's fallen in love with this guy and, you know, the Omar Epps character who really doesn't get it. And he's slow to get it like most men are. And there's a great scene toward the end where she tells him, you know, Quincy, I'll play you. And he said, play for what? I'll play you for your heart. And Michelle and Dan cello score, you know, the song, you know, You Made a Fool of Me. I mean, it is outside of Love Jones, this film here is probably second on the list of films that people really, really responded to and really, really love. Love and Basketball, 20 years, is actually released 21 years ago. Wow. It is still a standard bearer and a film that I still highly recommend. And when it's on, I try to watch it. It's just a really good film.
Yeah, doesn't that make you feel old to say that was 21 years ago? Hard to believe.
It does.
Awesome. And then got time for one more to highlight here. A brand new one just came out last year, Sylvie's Love with Tessa Thompson. You know, she had underrated romance. She's the new Rocky and Adrian, you know, with Michael B. Jordan in the Creed movies. Of course, she's in Dear White People and a bunch of other stuff. But I believe this, I know it's an Amazon movie on Amazon Prime, but did you first see it at Middleburg?
I did first see it at Middleburg. It was at Sundance also early in the year. Jason, I can't tell you how much I love this movie. I think the fact that I love Tessa Thompson and have watched her grow in her career in so many different roles throughout the Marvel Universe, indie stuff she's done. Her and former football player, Nnamdi Asamoah, yeah. Light up the screen in this story of a young woman who is a television fan, a music fan. And she works at her father's record shop. and she meets this guy, Robert, who comes and takes a summer job. He's a jazz musician. And we watch their romance. And what I love so much about what Eugene Ash did with this film is that it's not about class. It's not about race. It's literally two people who meet and over the summer fall in love. We see flashbacks. I thought their chemistry was fine. Again, as I said earlier, they overcome the challenges of what it takes to be in a relationship, his pride, her determination, and the two of them connect in a beautiful film with wonderful costumes, cinematography, score. Everything about Sylvie's Love, I think, makes it a modern classic. I love this film, and I think this is a film that we're going to be talking about 15, 20, 25 years from now as a film for this generation, as we talked about Love Jones and Love and Basketball as well.
Awesome. Now, I know you head up the Black Reel Awards. The nominations come out later this week. Can we expect to see Sylvie's Love on there?
You might. I think that's a pretty safe bet without saying yay or nay. Yeah, I think it's a pretty safe bet.
Exactly.
Sylvie's Love, really good. Really.
I think it might have missed. I don't think it won anything at WAFGA, but I hope we do see it on there later this week. That'll be cool. So everyone, there you go. There's your teaser. Everyone tune into the Black Reel Awards. Do you want to tease that really quick? You know, what year are we in, and you know, what's sort of the mission?
This will be the 21st annual Black Reel Awards, and the mission of the Black Reel Awards every year is to honor the achievements of African Americans and folks from the African diaspora. So that means that we can have Black Brits, anybody who's Black. We are honoring their work. And we've been doing these achievements in front of and behind the camera. And I think, you know, my press release later on this week will highlight the fact that this is a historic year. We've had over 30 African-American directors directing films across the streaming platforms. So it is a great year. And there's a lot of interesting nominees that folks are going to see this year that they have seen in other shows, but I think we're going to highlight them as well.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned Sylvie's Love. Trying to think what else comes to top of mind. I mean, Judas and the Black Messiah, I thought was freaking awesome. That just came out. One Night in Miami, maybe my favorite of the year, one of my favorites. What else did we have this year?
Oh, my God, man. What didn't we have?
The Five Bloods, Ma Rainey, yeah.
Yeah, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I mean, you had so many movies, and then there were small indies like Miss Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. The 40-year-old version. There were a lot of different choices this year. You know, even the holiday stuff like Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey. I mean, these were all films that I really thought the directors really stepped up and did a very strong job this year in their presentation of these films.
There, on the documentary side, you had Time.
All In. What was the other one? The Way I See It. Mr. Soul. I mean, there's just a lot of films across the board, Jason, in any genre that we can talk about this year. So it's to me, it's very humbling because I remember being there at the beginning back in 2000 when we didn't have the variety of films that we have now. And we had to really kind of pick through what was there or what was available at the time. And now it doesn't seem to be. Now it has gotten increasingly better, and I enjoy doing it just as much now as we did when we had to struggle at the beginning to find what I call very strong candidates.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm sure when you began, I'm sure it probably got frustrating. It's like, oh, another slave drama. Oh, you know, but now, like you're saying, every genre, there's great movies coming out across the board now. So it's almost like an embarrassment of riches when you sit down to do these nominees this year, I'm sure now.
Well, you know, it's funny because at the beginning, the first 5 years of, or maybe a little more after that, people would come to me after nominations were announced and I go, hey man, all I can do is honor what's there. There's nothing there. We're trying to do the best. We're picking from the best of what's there. I don't have to make those, you know, since 2010, we haven't had to have those conversations because there have been more Black creatives and more storytellers And, you know, you live in a world now of not just Spike Lee, but of course now Ava DuVernay and Barry Jenkins and Ryan Coogler. We got Shaka King this year. I mean, there are so many storytellers out there now, and I feel a lot better about what we're doing. And not to say I'm taking away from what we did at the beginning, but it's very fulfilling to see how it has evolved over two decades.
Absolutely. And of course, still always a way to go, work to be done. But yeah, I mean, look, if you look back and see how far we've come, it's actually pretty impressive. Like the filmmakers you're listing, it was a Spike Lee, John Singleton game almost exclusively for a while. And now you got Regina King and Shaka King and Ava DuVernay.
Yeah, I didn't even talk about Regina King and Eugene Ash and, yeah, you know, Alina Waithe and Melina Matsoukas. I mean, there's so many talented directors that are out there right now, and I can't wait to see as we move forward of some of these stories that we're going to look forward to even in 2021.
Absolutely. Real quick, the Oscars are way far away this year. It's going to be the longest Oscar season ever. It's not till April 25th, but do you think we'll find, like, was last year a tipping point that Parasite finally won? You know, we had Green Book the year before, and then now, but then they go the opposite way and get Parasite, which was a landmark, you know, moment. Do you think we're going to see more representation in the nominees this year? Or is it going to be the sad where we look at it and it's Oscar so white again?
Well, I think that the thing to really keep an eye on is, I call 2020 the year of the woman. Right. Even in our own awards, you'll see a little later on this week that women, the categories of actress are very, very strong. And I think that, along with director, when I watched the Golden Globes nominate three women as directors this year, I want to see if Oscar will follow suit with Chloe Zhao, Regina King, and Emerald Fennell. Or Fennel, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name.
I don't either.
But I'm really looking at that this year. And I think that, you know, when we talk about the actress category, that's the one to watch, because that's going to probably be the most competitive category, I think, in this year's Academy Awards, because four of them are already kind of set in stone. We know it's going to be Frances McDormand for Nomadland. We know it's going to probably be Viola Davis for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Carey Mulligan, we probably feel strong about with A Promising Young Woman. And Vanessa Kirby, I think, also is pretty much hovering around with Pieces of a Woman. That fifth spot, I'm very anxious to see, because the Globes picked Amy Adams from Hillbilly Elegy, which I was very shocked by. Clearly, you didn't see Andra Day in The U.S. versus Billie Holiday. You didn't see Zendaya in Malcolm versus Marie. I mean, Malcolm and Marie. So I think that last spot is going to kind of set the tone. But you're right. I think diversity is coming to the Oscars, and this might be the year in this 14-month eligibility period that there may be some surprises this year, and Oscar may do it in a way that's different than what they've done the first 92 years.
Yeah, fingers crossed. That's all we can do is hope. I think you're right. I think there's such a strong crop of nominees this year, you know, films starring or directed, written by people of color. I think maybe this will be the year the fever breaks. I hope. We can hope. So.
Well, we can hope. I mean, One Night in Miami, Regina King, you know, she's getting a lot of buzz. I would really be anxious, because you got to remember, there have only been six women in 92 years that have been nominated for best director.
That's
six.
Crazy. And only one is one.
And Kathryn Bigelow, that's it.
That's
so
bad.
If there's any year, Jason, if there's a breakthrough, you've got multiple films this year that are led or helmed by women that are very strong. And Chloe Zhao, I think, is almost a foregone conclusion that she's going to get an Oscar nomination. Will Regina King maintain that momentum along with the same momentum? And the question goes for Emerald Fennell. Mm-hmm. Will she maintain that momentum? Because it would be historic if three, I mean, it would be historic if two got nominated, but if three got nominated out of five.
Yeah. And I know it's not going to happen just reading the tea leaves, but I would almost say this year you could almost have, I wish there was a fourth. I wish Kelly Reichert was getting love for First Cow, but I don't think, I'm not, she's not going to get it, but
yeah, but like I said, man, I think anything is possible this year. And when you talk about the tea leaves, man, the tea leaves can change because it's all about momentum. But again, as you said at the top, this is the longest award season we've ever had. So sometimes it ebbs and flows and momentum. And, you know, that's why I keep using the N word. You got to see if you can maintain that momentum up until the time that voters are casting ballots, because some films kind of fade, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, right now, I mean, the smart money, Wafka, the champ, grand champ wound up being Nomadland. I feel like if there is a front runner, that's probably it. But to your point, it's such a long time. There's always such a thing as front runner fatigue. And I don't know, something in my gut tells me like a One Night in Miami is like, when I watch that movie, I'm like, wow, that's like tailor made for the Oscars. It appeals to sort of the old guard, but it also appeals to the new guard that they've admitted into the Academy. Like something about it, I think it could have a shot, but we'll have to see. If you had to pick, what do you think it'll be? You be thinking it's going to be Nomadland, or what's your pick?
Are you talking about for a nominee or for a winner?
I'm saying what do you think ultimately carries across the goal line as best picture? I know that's almost like predicting the Super Bowl in September, because we have like 3 months still, but 2 months still. But
well, my gut tells me that it's very hard to go wire to wire at the Academy Awards. It doesn't usually happen a lot. And the fact, I think Nomadland, I think, premiered at TIFF because it wasn't a Sundance film. And it low-key has been getting so much love. And, you know, it's funny you talked about it's finally coming out in theaters this week. It feels like Nomadland has been out for 6 months, man. Because everybody's seen it already.
It played at Middleburg here, yeah.
They played at Middleburg here. And it just feels, but I guess here's my caveat. I think Nomadland has a very strong chance. I would put even money on it to win. But the bigger question is going to be Frances McDormand, because the other interesting side note about Oscar is there are only 5 people in Academy history that have won 3 Oscars. 5.
Yeah.
And there's only one person that's won 4, and that was Katharine Hepburn. So this Mount Rushmore-esque club that the Academy has, you know, the interesting play here is going to be, or the interesting watch is going to be, does McDormand win the incredible number 3, or does Viola Davis win her first Best Actress Oscar? Because she's got a supporting actress for The Help, but she's never won Best Actress.
It was Fences. It was Fences, remember?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did she win for Fences as well?
No, she.
I'm sorry. She lost.
She's tragically lost for The Help and won for Fences. Yep. Yep.
Okay, so my apologies. She has her Best Supporting Actress for Fences, and will she win another one? Because she won in an August Wilson film before.
True.
So this is another August Wilson story, and she's done the work. She has the look. So again, the only thing I think stopping Frances McDormand this year would be Viola Davis, to be perfectly honest. And there could be an outside surprise with Carey Mulligan, who I thought was brilliant and Promising Young Woman. But those are the only two people that I think that stand a stone's throw chance against Frances McDormand winning that third Oscar. And it's political, man, because think, Robert De Niro doesn't have 3. Denzel Washington doesn't have 3. Tom Hanks doesn't have 3. So there are a lot of really strong actors that we know who have never gotten over that 3 goal line. Can McDormand be the one?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the race to watch. Whether is she going to enter the Mount Rushmore territory, or is it going to be the woman who should be on Mount Rushmore, which is Viola Davis, because she should be there already. But if she notches number 2, then, you know, then she could enter that territory in a future role. So yeah, I think you're right. I think every year there's one race we hone in on to that we eat our popcorn, because a lot of the others, a lot of years feel like foregone conclusions, but that race, man, I think is going to be the exciting one this year.
Chadwick Boseman's going to win Best Actor this year. I mean, just write that down for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Nobody, I mean, I hate to say it. I mean, you know, it's not like there's a lot of suspense. And you're right, but I'm really keen on several categories. The Best Director we talked about earlier. I want to see how many women are nominated this year for Best Director, because if it's only one, that would be tragic. It really would. If Regina King and Emerald Fennell get snubbed, that would be tragic. It really would.
I agree. And the Best Director, they're way behind on women. Obviously, way behind on African-American, a Black director. Spike should have won years ago. But they're trying to, I feel like in that category, they've been trying to level the playing field slightly, at least like with, we've seen like, you know, Latino directors win a lot lately. You know, we've seen the Guillermo del Toro's and the Alfonso Cuarón's and the Alejandro Iñárritu. Last year was Bong Joon-ho. I feel like they have opened up diversity in that category in the last like 10 years, but still, we still haven't yet to see, you know, a Black director. So progress, but still a way to go, man. You know?
Well, yeah, we've gotten Black directors before, but again, I keep honing in on women, man, because, you know, as a Black man, you know, for years, it was always a struggle that we need more representation. And I think Hollywood, as I said, over the last 10 years, has taken major steps to open the door up for more creatives and more storytellers. But I really feel bad for women. And I remember being at Sundance a couple of years ago and seeing a documentary called Half the Picture. That was a documentary about what we're talking about right now, about how there have been so many women directors over time who have literally gotten snubbed because it's an all boys club. Yeah. And the fact that we're in 2021 and it's 92 years of Academy Awards and there's only been 6 women nominated in itself, it sounds unfathomable to me.
Yeah.
That this has gone on for 9 decades, that women have been kind of shaded by the Academy. 90 plus years.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that traverses everything from, you know, Agnes Varda to, I mean, there's a million you could name. I mean, what are some, Catherine Bigelow was the only one to win, but there's been a million over the time. Who else do you think we should have probably got it over the years?
Well, I mean,
Ida Lupino.
Ida Lupino, of course, was ignored because, you know, we're talking about the 1950s, so it's a very different time. I just think that for so many years, you didn't have a lot of women who had the opportunity to direct what I call these kind of awards-worthy, award-centric sorts of films.
The prestige pictures.
And when they did make them, people didn't do the push to get them out there. So I think there are a lion's share reasons when you ask about which women should have had the opportunity. I say a bunch of them. So many of them that we can't even just individually name them. But it is so glaring now over the last 20 years because there's so many women out there that are making so many quality films that we enjoy who just get snubbed because there's a guy someplace. And, you know, and if I'm coming down on male directors, I mean, they know. You guys know that there are, like I remember Ava DuVernay several years ago for Selma. Didn't get a Best Director nomination for that, but it got it was a film that was one of the contenders that year and it deserved that kind of acclaim. I'm trying to think of what
Dee Reese Mudbound, and it's similar to Selma, gets nominations in other categories, Best Picture, but doesn't, not director, and she directed the hell out of that movie.
She did, man. So, you know,
did Greta Gerwig get nominated for Lady Bird for directing?
That's a very good question, because I remember there was a brouhaha. I'm not sure if she did or not. And I apologize for not knowing that, because her film, we were all at Middleburg with her back in 2018 when they were really pushing for that film. I'm not sure, Jason. Are you looking it up?
I'm checking it right now, because I remember that being the big controversy. She was one of the rare exceptions that actually got nominated for directing and screenplay, but of course did not win. But I mean, even Black directors like Spike waited how many years and finally got it for a, you know, adapted screenplay for Black Klansman, but he should have won for best director. And then you have other examples where we've seen black directors on stage. You know, Barry Jenkins got to go up there for best picture for Moonlight, but he didn't win best director. And then Steve McQueen gets to go up for best picture for 12 Years a Slave, but he didn't win best director. Like, it seems like they all, even the black movies that do break through, their creators aren't really rewarded in kind. So I don't know. It's very frustrating.
Five black men have been nominated for best director. Five. None of them have won, but five have been nominated. And, you know, these are hurdles when you talk about women, you talk about African-Americans, you talk about other minorities. Hollywood was kind of what it is, man. It was an old boys network that, you know, first Academy Awards in 1927. It's been a long time, man. And yeah, as you can clearly see, there's still a lot of work to be done. It has gotten increasingly better. But my issue with the Oscars has always been that instead of voting for what the best thing is that particular year, there's always debts that need to be paid. Hence, Denzel Washington doesn't win Best Actor for Malcolm X because Al Pacino right. had been nominated 7 times and it never won, and they wanted to take care of Al. Yeah. Russell Crowe should have won for A Beautiful Mind, but he had a blowout at BAFTA that year. And Denzel Washington gets a makeup Oscar for Training Day. So it's always a situation where we're always rewarding people after the fact yeah. for things. And Denzel Washington, I assume, one day will win a third Oscar because he's been, you know, for lack of a better term, had two of them taken from him. Casey Affleck, of course, for Manchester by the Sea, took the Oscar that Denzel should have won for Fences.
He should have easily won that year. He won at SAG, too, right? Denzel won at SAG. And I said, here we go. The number three of anyone deserves it is Denzel. And then they give it to Casey. But
yeah, man, it happens. It happens. And it's funny because I always say on my own show that one of the other oversights is Sidney Poitier won an Oscar in 1963 for a film I'm not really a big fan of called Lilies of the yeah. Field. Paul Newman should have won that year for Hood. He was yeah. great.
Yeah.
He was great in Hood. Poitier should have won either in 1967 for one of those three films or yeah. in 1961 for Raisin in the Sun, which was clearly his probably one of his strongest performances.
Right.
So I don't think that the Academy has, for the most part, they've gotten it right a lot of times, but they've gotten it wrong also a lot of times when it comes to awarding, you know, these individuals. You can look at Whoopi Goldberg, who should have gotten acclaim for The Color Purple,
yeah.
but had to wait until Ghost.
Yeah. It's always the makeup awards, man. It's always like you're saying, and that becomes itself a domino effect that is in stealing the award from the rightful winner in the future years. It's always frustrating, but like you're saying, it's usually a good performance that wins, but it's usually not the best one. Like, and we always look back and we say, you know, Black Panther is more culturally significant than Green Book, or Do the Right Thing was way better than Driving Miss Daisy. There's always, I don't know. It's almost like people can't see the forest for the trees when we're in the moment, you know? And then you look back and you say, oh yeah, of course it should have been Denzel for Malcolm X, but it's frustrating.
Let's talk about Morgan Freeman, who should have got an Oscar nomination for Street Smart, but he didn't win for Street Smart, but 5 years later, they gave it to him for Driving Miss Daisy. Let's talk about
I don't want to interrupt or correct you, but I thought Morgan had to wait until Million Dollar Baby to win. I don't think he ever won. He might have been nominated for Driving Miss Daisy, but I don't think
he won. He might. You're correct. And you feel free to cut me off if I'm wrong, but I'm saying that Street Smart, I think when he played Fast Black, the pimp, and again, maybe it wasn't a wonderful image, but he was great. He stole that movie and didn't get any acclaim. Same thing with Sam Jackson, who should have gotten a nomination for Jungle Fever. He was great in that film as Gator. So yeah. you can always go back and re-legislate the things that you know, the performance that people didn't get him for. But I was trying to say Shakespeare in Love, to me was the worst one, because the fact that Saving Private Ryan lost Best Picture and Shakespeare in Love. I haven't seen Shakespeare in Love since Shakespeare in Love came out in 1998. But I have watched Saving Private Ryan over and over, and that is such a really strong film.
Arguably the greatest war movie of all time versus a creative screenplay period piece, but that no one talks about anymore. You know? So
Yeah, I agree.
I could sit and we could go year by year. I could talk all day with you, and I'm sure we will on many other occasions, but thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate it. But to bring it full circle, this whole conversation we're having is sort of the reason why I wanted to have you on and do this, because I feel like, you know, and when you look back and all the history of all the great movies, and then you're trying to go back and pick what are the best romances ever. If all you're doing is going back, and again, I'm guilty of this too from time to time. If all you're doing is going back and looking at a list of, all right, let's see what all was nominated, or let's pull up this AFI countdown and then, you know, put together, you're missing, like you're saying, half the story, half of the great movies could have been directed by women, but weren't, or people of color, you know, like what great movies were never even made that could be the greatest of all time. You know, it's kind of sad.
It is sad, man, but it speaks to when we talk about art, man. I mean, it's very subjective. You have films like, take for instance, I know you and I respect you as a critic, and I've listened and watched some of the films that you've saluted. You know, I'm a guy who's kind of a historian. I've been watching, you know, I start at the beginning of our industry and then kind of take it forward. I love Turner Classic Movies. I always try to find if there's a classic that I've heard about but didn't see, if an opportunity comes to watch it, I'm checking it out. So it depends on, you know, your love of film, how deep you want to dive down that rabbit hole, and to understand and make the connection of what you watched in the past from the golden age of Hollywood between 1910, 1960, and how we are moving the art forward. Because there's only like 6 to 12 original stories, and then everything else is a variation of something we've already seen. Absolutely is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we love film though, and I respect your love of film, Jason.
Oh, right back at you, man. I feel like I can learn from you every day too, man. So thanks for coming on and doing this.
Man, my pleasure, man. Anytime you need me, I'm here, man. Just throw up a bat signal, and I'm here.
I have to during COVID. The bat signal needs to be bigger and brighter. All right, man. Hey, stay safe and good luck with the Black Reel nominees later this week.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you, and I'll definitely get it out to you so you have a release before it hits the public.
All right, cool. Stay safe, my friend.
You too, man. You take care, man.